It's Wednesday, January 24th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 36 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and around yon mics are Chad.
Howdy.
Adam.
Hi.
John.
Hello.
And Chris.
Hey.
Now, Chris is an author that used to work for the FASA Corporation, who has come down here to visit us for the weekend, and he will be doing a couple of episodes with us. And Chris and Chad are sharing a mic, and Chad, I want you to know that when you leaned in just there, it sounded great. So be sure to keep that going.
Chad and I are going to do harmony, singing harmony
Dan,
later on.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You sound great every single episode.
Chad's job for this one episode is to wreck Fear the Boot's normally flawless sound balance.
By chewing gum.
And setting
chewing
his class
gum
down.
In line, eh?
And trying to make out with Chris.
Trying?
Facial hair.
Today's spooky episode is
brought to you by Petta Smiles.
I grew the Van Dyke over in Rome, and there's a Petta Smile picture of me, and it is 100%. I'll try to upload it to the forums, see if I can find it.
Johnny G and his quote-unquote questing through Rome.
Yes. I got a lot of experience points over
there.
Yeah,
you know, I'm actually kind of sad because when you came back, we were hoping to have a really good bonus episode about these wild and zany adventures you had in Rome, and you, like, brought us nothing.
But Johnny G is 67 years
There's
old.
There's really nothing there. I mean,
just if except for to, thousands of years of architecture.
Yeah. No, I mean in the trip story, not Rome.
Rome's just an Arctic wasteland.
Blah, blah, blah,
everybody
Rome,
left and
blah,
came
blah,
to
blah,
America.
Blah.
That's the Pope magic. Is,
the show came over here, man.
So did you get to meet the Pope?
I got to see him.
Fly?
Not quite.
Did you see
he
him
only
shoot
does
laser
that on Christmas
beams
Eve. Out of his eyes? I did see the laser beam.
Did you see
he can do that every day.
Was Robert Langdon running around solving codes?
No, he was not, but we saw the one hotel that they reference in both the books. I forget what it's called, but it's
when
there.
When the Pope was shooting the laser beam, was Pink Floyd playing?
No, but I went to a Pink Floyd cover band concert on their White Night, they call it. They open up all the stores and restaurants. Everything's mm-hmm. free. And well, not everything in the stores aren't free, but the restaurant admission is.
Excellent and, for business.
Yeah. You know what? Here in America, restaurant admission is free as well.
Well, they don't run them from 12 p.m. to 6 a.m. Well, some do, but not all of them. I mean, like, the good places were open all night.
You're not selling me on this place, John. I mean, you're really not.
Yeah, go back to Costa Rica.
I'd love to.
The topic for today, when we get to the game design part of the show.
Seems like an eternity away.
It is an eternity away, but we are finally out of the soft subjects, as we've been calling them, and today we are starting...
We're going into the hardcore subjects.
We're talking about rules, math, numbers, models,
triple X role-playing game design.
You're going to love the resource document.
But I roll from
Adam.
There.
It's our first NSFW resource document.
It's hard and in your face.
It's a picture of Adam and I role-playing.
In a yiff.
The hard part can't even look at that stuff.
Only
he's
one
like,
of us
guys,
in costume. We've broken
oh,
through.
Oh, look at that sass. I didn't think you liked LARPing.
Let's move on.
All right. Well, we're starting.
Now it's getting inappropriate.
We're going to start talking about the rules today. And where we are beginning, and I'm not going to explain why just yet, but we are going to start actually with what we are calling the character model, which is more or less the stuff that goes on the character sheet. And we'll explain why we consider that the first step we want to cover. But before that, while we were working through some of the stuff for Skies of Glass today, we were before the podcast sitting around having a discussion about the rules, we got to talking about how we wanted to handle character advancement. This was at the end of a long series of topics.
Don't do it. Ever.
And
rewarding players is awful.
And the thing that we kind of got stuck on was, why is it that rewarding play in the form of character advancement is so integral to the role-playing experience? Because at one point I started talking, I said, you know, if you think about it, the average person, they may grow a lot in the course of weeks or months or whatever. But for the most part, if you think about a person as a character sheet, it's not as if anyone is going to go to work today, come home, and quick into some vastly more powerful creature.
Honey, I killed the boss today. My grenade skill went up 3 points.
This big 300 number popped out of his chest as he slumped
to
the floor.
You know what, for some reason, I can detect evil now. I don't know why that is.
But Chris made the point.
Honey, you're showing up.
Pretty much every role-playing game out there has character advancement, which running through my, just kind of running through the games in my head, he's right that I could come up with one or two exceptions that did not have any form of character advancement, but most did. And I'm just kind of curious, I guess maybe why this is important, but more or less, what do you guys sitting here on the table think about that? Is it important to you?
You know
I
what?
Hold the minority opinion on this.
Chad, go ahead. You always do.
Personally, I do not like the idea of rewarding characters, rewarding players with stats, numbers, and equipment. I see it as, you know, you're role-playing, you're creating this story together. To me, the advancement of the character is just that, the advancement of the character and not the stats and numbers. Who cares about the stats and numbers? Obviously, this is the minority opinion, and tons of people don't play
so
this
So virtue
way.
Is its own reward, eh, Chad?
I think so.
But, you know, to a certain extent, I can agree with that in theory. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that you're still dealing with human beings, and
yes.
when it comes down to it, and this was kind of my main point as we had the discussion, it all comes down to a matter of control. Mm-hmm. And if the players do not feel as if they have a sense of some sort of control over their characters outside of the development of the storyline, they lose their investment in that game and in that character. And character advancement is an excellent way of giving that player control yeah. over the development of his character.
I can see that. Adam and John, you guys played under me for several years.
Yes.
And
we still do.
Rarely, if ever, handed out any kind of character advancement or anything like that. What was your guys' take on that?
I don't know if you didn't ever hand out any advancement. You didn't hand out experience points. You didn't hand out levels as such.
I've been in games where you've handed out experience.
You give us stuff. Mm-hmm. You wet our whistles with regards to progress. You'll drop a cool sword or let us take over the castle or something.
This is a material reward, though. We're talking specifically here about stat advancement.
And generally, I don't give much in the way
yeah,
of material reward.
Yeah, from what
either.
I understood... That was your claim, that you really didn't give much material work. Yeah. I've heard you speak about your gaming philosophy of throwing your players a bone. Every mm-hmm. once in a while, make sure they're taken care of, that they get something cool, that they get to do something cool, whatever.
Depends on what the individual person's
exactly.
want
You throw
is.
Phil a bazooka,
yeah.
you throw me a magistracy or something.
Yeah, Phil needs the stuff,
yeah.
and I give Phil the stuff. You need, like you said, you... Our influence.
Let's
power
get back to the original point there, though.
All right, let me answer
How did
question.
You guys feel about that? How did that
I
work for you?
I never had a problem with
they
you.
They worked just fine for me.
Yeah, I never
I've
had a problem
said time
with
and again, I love playing Chad's games.
Thank you.
And to answer sure. Dan's question, earlier today he was talking about, well, should we have character advancement in SOG? And my immediate reaction was, yeah, we have to have it. And then I could not back that up with any sort of tangible reason why I felt so strongly that I had to reject
you know
that idea out of hand.
I don't do character advancement in the traditional sense. And I think Skies of Glass should have character advancement because that is what people want. The way I do it is different and off the wall.
Yeah, there's a trait of human psychology, and I can't think what this is called. I'm sure somebody...
Herd mentality?
No, I'm sure somebody...
The one where the mouse hits the bottle, and if it only does it sometimes, he'll go crazy about it and keep hitting it.
No, well, yeah, I mean, could play into that. Like, for example, if you're in a corporation and they make a poor investment, they start up a new department, pour all kinds of money into it, and it just plain does not work. I mean, it's failing, losing money. But because of the fact that they have already invested X number of millions of dollars into it, they cannot accept the idea that it will fail, and they will continue to just pump and pump and pump money into this
Is it
thing.
Monoculture?
Oh, my gosh, I live that
Until
yeah.
finally, just somewhere down the road, this thing is completely out of control. It's a scandal within the corporation, and maybe somebody shuts it down. They've noted this as well with the MMOs, that the best way to keep people coming back is to give them some kind of a return. That if people advance to level 2 into level 3 into level 4, they will keep coming back to it, even if they aren't that fond of the game, because they cannot bear the idea of giving up that investment or that progress.
Absolutely true. My MUD has been running for 10 years old, and there are people who will not leave because they put so much into it, they can't imagine breaking off because they'd lose play
they
years.
Lose nothing.
Not play days. No, they lose nothing. Yeah, but it was all this nothing they'd worked so hard to get.
It's purely psychological. Yeah. It's like within a corporation, they do not think about how much money they'd save by shutting down a department.
Exactly.
They only think about how much money they would quote unquote waste by, you know, the act of shutting it down. They don't see
all the money
that.
They've spent up to that point.
And I've got to think that this rears its head in role playing to some degree. This is part of the attraction of leveling. That the more your character grows, the more you have advanced that character, the more that people get attached to it. And some of that, it comes from a fondness of just familiarity. The longer you've played a character, even if there's no advancement, the more you like the character. But
you know, that's a weird thing, too, because that's another way I don't run games typically. Because my games usually last for about a handful of months in game time. They have
your
a beginning,
a
middle,
year.
And an end, and we never touch the characters again. I have them make new characters.
If our characters never advanced in these campaigns, what kind of gaming stories would we tell at cons?
Very true.
My demon gnome would never have gotten the staff.
With a generic 2-gold dagger.
Listen, listen. A level 2 gaming story does not impress fat gaming dorks at cons.
I'm going to go ahead and give something of a defensible defense for the practice of leveling, and that it allows different levels and flavors of gameplay within the same rule system. Play D&D at level 1, played at level 10, played at level 20.
Well,
you're trying to play in different
games.
It's
the old cliche. You can have a level 1 character, but there's no such thing as a level 1 adventure.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and the thing is, despite the fact that how wonderful it is, everybody still would eventually have to acknowledge that the concept of leveling is just fundamentally wrong. It just makes absolutely no sense.
That's an abstraction, just like rolling D20 to see if you hit someone with a sword.
They had to put a mechanic to it, and that's the one they picked.
Well, but just to narrow things down here, little John, you mentioned that the different levels allow different kinds of play, which is true, but that does not necessarily mean you have to allow character advancement once the game is begun.
Oh, no, not. If you want to play a level 1 campaign, you can do it. In fact, a lot of people I know will start at level 10 or 12 and perhaps make one level within the course of their entire month-long game. It's just how they play.
I guess my opinion on this is kind of split. I definitely want to feel like my character's progressing somehow, but I see this as a full menu. Like Chad, I can accept that a character growth may be personality, may be involvement in the story, may be some kind of material growth, but I would also add to that that part of growth can be, does not have to be for me, but can be attribute points and skill points and levels. And sometimes this is necessary, because in some games, when you start out, Battletech is a good example, the base MechWarrior character, Shadowrun's another example, you just don't have enough skills to do everything that you need to do in a well-rounded game.
That doesn't mean do everything and be a twin character. That means just be a well-rounded character.
And you need that some kind of an advancement to help you get to the point where you can cover more bases. I do see something in that. And I guess also like in some games, D&D is an example, but not the only one, where we are constantly facing enemies that are not on our level. Like in Battletech, my mech is really the same as his mech in all probability. You know, I mean, he may have a different model, but it's not like I have some kind of a mech and he has just some super mega mech that I can't possibly attain to.
Well, you're in a locust and he's in a grand dragon, I would say that.
Well, but true, but I mean,
I agree.
You could hop in his mech at any time and run with it. It's not the same as D&D where you're the level 1 guy and here comes the level 15 evil overlord. And you've got no way of killing him unless you progress to his level. And so I guess in those cases as well that I see
that's going to be a long campaign.
It could be. It depends on how people choose to run
it. Or a very, very short one.
But, you know, there are games that, you know, do kind of even that playing field a little bit. Not perfectly, but they do. And I do think that Shadowrun actually did that very well. Your base character, when you created them, had a certain level of competency that you could drop that character into a campaign that maybe had some more, you know, quote unquote advanced characters, and he could still, you know, keep pace with them. I mean, I get as many D6 as the other characters, but he's got enough where he could stand toe to toe with something.
Well, he should have played Star Wars. He can get as many as he wanted that game.
Go West End.
I still say that the reward of the player should be your involvement in the story. The story itself is the reward. But that's how hardly anyone at all sees it, except me.
I think it should be the sound that 26-sided dice make when I release them on my mom's kitchen table.
Amen, brother.
Well, I guess this is one of the reasons why we chose to put some kind of character advancement within Skies of Class, because even if you know, it's not unanimous around this table whether it's necessary or not, or even really, we had quite a debate about what pace it should occur at.
Yes, we did.
But we, you know, it's such an important part of play to so many people that I think if we didn't put it out, it'd be one of the first things that people would either clamor for or probably write their own rules to make up for.
If you don't interrupt him, he'll never shut up. So go ahead, cut in.
Yeah. No, well, I wanted him to finish the statement because I wanted to essentially add to that, that I think another justification for character advancement actually really fits part of the field document when you think about it, because advancing
we're
your
being bludgeoned with our own field document.
Listen, we don't really talk about that off the podcast. It's just something we made up. Something we wildly pontificate about that isn't actually real.
Actually, we just found it on the internet. That's someone else's.
It's like the British Constitution. It's unwritten, but we refer to it as if it existed.
You just crossed out the word and wrote in skies of glass. Yes. This looks pretty good. No, I think one of the fundamental concepts of the game, as you've said this several times, is hope. One of the principles really behind character advancement is hope, and you're looking towards that future. Your characters, you've set goals for your character, and you're pushing, although in a rather dangerous career, pushing towards trying to accomplish those goals.
Right.
And I think that this does follow in that vein in a certain way, very philosophically and high-mindedly.
I very much agree.
Yeah, and I don't know if we're going to get to
calling me low-minded.
I
don't know if we're going to get to it today, because we're not actually going to talk about character creation or advancement today. We're just talking about the character model. But we are actually going to talk about that concept there of hope. We'll actually come up again in what we came up with for character advancement, because you actually set goals for your character and play those out. And we're going to talk about how we're actually going to do that.
Shh, don't give it away.
I didn't give it away. I just named it. I named its forbidden name. And now there's a great black cloaked figure looming over me, preparing to drag my soul to the seventh hell.
He's pretty cool. I can't wait to game with that guy.
Actually, he's just here to tell you that you ate the salmon loaf.
I ate the fugu. All right, character model.
Have you ever eaten fugu? My brother has.
Has he really?
Yes, he has.
Not here in Missouri.
Wait. Oh, hell no. He went to Japan.
Has he eaten fugu or fubu?
Fugu.
Fugu.
No,
fubu is a type of clothing.
He might have worn fubu in seventh grade when he was a little disoriented. But, the blowfish that kills you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've never actually had it.
Did he like it?
I think he said it was rather unremarkable, other than the fact that he might have died.
Right. Yeah. And that it...
Yeah, it serves me as a Cuban cigar when I was in Venezuela. We tried Cuban cigars, and I have to say that, honestly, the Dominicans are better.
Yeah, I had a Cuban or two when I was in Rome, and it was good, but
cigar.
Chad has brought me five different better cigars, none of them from Cuba.
Exactly, yeah. The attraction to Cuba, the Cuban cigar, is just it's the forbidden fruit thing.
Exactly.
Same thing with the fugu. It's just the forbidden, you know, it's dangerous, it's restricted.
Rocky Patel vintage 90s for all you aficionados out there.
Because all the Cuban cigars taste like Castro.
They do taste like Castro. They are about to be made of ground up Castro, because there's about to be a surplus of dead Castro on the market.
If there's not already.
Man, now we're going to fear the boot forbidden from another country. Before we get into our game design topic, we have forgot to make an important announcement, which is...
Like, who the hell Chris Hussey is?
No. We don't care.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
I don't care who I am.
This coming Friday, January the 26th...
Wing night.
We are celebrating Fear the Boot's first international holiday, Worldwide Wing Night.
You know, we gave this a blurb like two episodes ago.
We did, and we're going to give it one again.
And last episode.
Oh, okay. Thank you for being here.
So the way you celebrate this is wherever you are,
read the memos.
Around sometime in the evening, this Friday, this coming Friday, all you got to do is go get a big bucket of wings, copious amounts of beer, and enjoy them. And that's really about it. And send us pictures we can put on the forum.
If you're a Fear the Boot listener, get on our forums. See if you can dig somebody up that is in your area and go with them. That'd be even better. Take pictures and such. If you don't want to do that, grab your gaming group, grab whoever, or just go by yourself. But yeah, take some pictures, come to our forums, put them up. We're going to take pictures, and hopefully I can convince Dan to bring the micro recorder, and we might even actually do a bonus episode either at the bar or afterwards.
Or if you have a pair of wings, put them on yourself and take a picture and send it to Adam.
And also, if you are in the St. Louis area or able to get to the St. Louis area, we will be going to a place in Fenton, Missouri called That One Place. That's literally its name, at 7 o'clock on Friday. So please come and join us if you're a St. Louis listener or, like I said, can get to the St. Louis area.
Directions are...
It's 7.
No, it's a 7.
All right. Directions are on our forums.
Yeah, and stop by the feartheboot.com forums. We'd love to see you guys both on the forums and at W3N this coming Friday. All right, game design topic. when we're looking at rules, there's kind of a step zero that we are going to skip over. We may talk about here for a couple minutes, but we're not going to talk about it too much because we already did. The very first step that you'd have to come up with is some kind of a base mathematical model for your game. How many dice are you going to roll? What kind of dice are you going to roll? How are you going to calculate success?
Fear the statistics.
And we are
what
not-
do you do if a dice falls off the table? What do you do if it leans up and it's like kind of a four but kind of a two?
No, this is not the show about house rules for cheaters.
You flip it back to a six.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a miracle. When you drop a D20 on the floor and it's a 20, it stays.
Good.
When it's
that's
a one,
right.
Oh, it fell on the floor. I'm going to re-roll
what
it.
What was it? Oh, don't worry about it. It fell on the floor.
I love the move where they roll it off the table, but they won't. They won't even move to get it. Like, they'll make that half-ass move to get it because it's still rolling. And they won't make a serious bid until it stops. And then if they don't like it,
they'll grab it real quick.
Real quick. Boom!
Oh, I didn't even see what that was.
You've never seen a fat bastard move so quick.
We had a player who constantly would just basically sit there and roll dice all the time. And so whenever it came up, he would either, depending on what the roll was, it was either, oh, no, this is the one that really counts. Or, oh, there it is right there. I got my 20.
Wow.
So we are not going to review that stuff because we talked about that in the very first podcast we did in the game design series. So we are going to skip right over that step. The only thing we're going to tell you real quick is what we decided on is that we are going to scale most of the game off of D6s simply because they are so common. They're so everybody has them and they're not all that difficult to get if you need more. We are going to scale attributes on a 2 to 12. So they're going to be on 2D6 scale more or less. And with the skills, we've decided we're not going to base them on a consistent series of dice, but instead, based on the level of skill you had, you're going to add another die or so. But this is not going to be like Western Star Wars. There's going to be a hard cap at three dice.
Yes.
Nobody's rolling 18 dice for anything. The most dice you will ever roll in this game for a skill roll is going to be like three dice, you know, something in that range.
We'll use modifiers as progress marks as well.
Exactly.
So we won't get to 12d6,
right,
like I said earlier, even though I wish it would.
So we'll come back and talk about that a little more actually here, even within this podcast in the next topic, which let's go roll right into that. The place we saw as being the next step of rules design after you've picked a base mathematical model is the character model. Now, let me define the character model, then let's explain why it's so significant. The character model is really simply put, what is on the character sheet? How you are choosing to represent a character mathematically, what those numbers mean, how you roll against them, how many attributes you put down there. And the reason that we are choosing to make this the center of the rules is because, in truth, most of your rules come off of this design. That if you start making skill checks, well, what is that based on? Well, it's based on the skill that is on that sheet. The highest it could possibly be, the lowest it could possibly be, how you save against it, the kinds of margins of success that are mathematically possible. When you start talking about damage, weapon attacks, tons and tons of rules fundamentally have their root at how a character is mathematically represented. And so this is the place that we want to begin the game design. So let's start talking about character models and how they've been used within other games. And, of course, here at the end, we'll talk a little bit about how we're doing it in Skies of Glass and move on from there. Character models. If you look at character sheets for most games, the character seems to fundamentally occur in three parts. Assuming you don't have magic, we'll leave magic as an optional fourth part. Attributes, skills, gear.
I agree.
And yeah, I realize once again, some games may have a little something more in there. They may have some specific combat stats.
In
or
Vampire
some,
the Masquerade, there's an angst.
Yeah,
there's an angst section.
Perks and flaws, or your
force points,
humanity meter, or whatever. But fundamentally, the character boils down in damn near every game out there to three things, which is attributes, skills, and gear.
I agree.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say advantages because that's BattleTech.
Attributes, skills, and advantages. No. What do you guys think? Does that work?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I can say there's not a lot of games that deviate from it, but honestly, this is one of those things where a lot of times it's like, you know, most role-playing games do this, and I feel they're missing out on something like...
It's thinking inside the box, and for the past 10 years, you know, corporate America and motivational speakers have been telling us, think outside the box, think outside the box. Generally, I don't have a problem with thinking outside the box, but this works.
Yeah,
I've never played a game where we've rejected the game quite frankly straight out of hand because of these three games.
And we've made tons of games from really, really super complex stuff to just simple stuff, just bashed out.
And they all have these three.
I have been a long-winded and vociferous opponent of reinventing the wheel. And even when we do it all the time, we still keep the strength, the skills, and the stuff.
Yeah, see, I don't think this is an issue of not thinking outside the box so much as it is if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly. Because the box works.
What you're really trying to do with the character sheet is you are trying to take a human, more or less. Okay, I realize some games doesn't have humans, but fundamentally, you're taking the human existence and you are trying to find some way to represent it mathematically that is complex enough to be meaningful, but is simple enough to be usable.
Well, I remember earlier today when I came in and we were talking about creating the character system for a game, and you were like, okay, let's try and think outside the box. And then I was like, shapes, colors. And you're like, no.
But yeah, I just don't see any problem with it, because if you really, I guess if you think about it, you can think of yourself in three parts: nature, nurture, and possessions. And if you look at this in a role-playing game, attributes are your nature, what you are. Skills are your nurture, what you have learned. Your equipment list is your possessions.
What if somebody came to you and said, I'm writing a role-playing game, and I have a system, and they're not going to tell you what the system is.
Right.
They have a system where they don't use attributes, skills. They have, I mean, they have gear because that's nouns, and reality deals with nouns. But they don't have the intangible, quantifiable stuff like attributes and skills.
They are plant the role-playing game.
Well, what exactly are they coming to me for? They're telling me about this. Okay.
Yeah, they're like, I have the system, but I heard your podcast where you said, don't do it. Should I not do it? Should I throw my system
out? Well, we haven't said don't do it.
Yeah, we haven't said don't do it.
We just said we're not doing it here.
I would say it's definitely going to be an uphill battle, because I really think this is one of the paradigms of RPGs, where the functional paradigm, the way people have always done it, is basically right. You can improve on it some, I think, by the attributes you choose to use or the way you choose to roll them or represent them. But if somebody came to me and said, look, I've got a way of breaking the paradigm, I'd be interested in hearing it, because I'm not so naive or arrogant as to think that this is the best that can possibly be.
I would say that.
And
I also would say that.
But
I would probably toss my vote in there, too.
I hate Shadowrun.
Me too.
But, you know, I would be willing to hear them. It would definitely be an uphill battle to me. You know, I kind of like sit down and say, look, explain this to me. How are you going to do this in a way it's meaningful? And to explain Chad's colors and shapes joke, that I had some friends a while back that were dorking around with trying to radically diverge from the current system of role playing. And they said a few things, and I don't remember the details of their system, and because their system probably shouldn't go into it anyway. But I later, taking some of the things they had said, some of my own ideas, was playing around with, is there a way to try and represent the human existence in a way that's a little bit more esoteric?
I think there is.
It's more art than math.
I have a strength of triangle.
But that's it. You wouldn't say I have a strength of triangle, and this is more than I care to explain in the podcast, just because it gets fairly complicated. But imagine if you could, first of all, forget that whole paradigm. You're not necessarily representing strength, that you have traits to yourself.
I love
that. For example, you may say, like, your primary color is red, and that would mean something to you, that this represents certain traits of your attributes, certain strengths of your personality, and this would correspond to the game. But see, what you're trying to do is you're trying to take that current paradigm of I am attributes and stuff that into shapes and colors, which wasn't the direction it was headed. It was more like we're putting aside this model completely and trying to redefine the way you look at a person.
My fifth level fighter has a chewy finish with nice pear and apricot almond flavors.
Exactly.
Like, well,
see, here's the thing though. Chad's exactly right. The joke that he's making is, of course, facetious and hyperbole, but it's basically right, because that's the direction it heads. That you hit this point where it's so unusual that it's almost difficult to even follow.
See, and that's the problem, is that, yes, I think that, yes, it can be done, but your average consumer, and it comes down to the money, because you can design a game, but if you want to try and sell that game, you have to appeal to that consumer, and there'd be no way that it would fall flat, because your average consumer is not going to buy into that lofty.
The only thing really different than this that we had once messed with was treating all characters as a deviation from the norm. And the way it works is this. When you have a character sheet, that character sheet is completely blank. Okay, it is assumed that, let's say this is a system on a D20 roll, that you have effectively 50-50 chances of succeeding at anything in the world. You have straight tens on all your attributes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what you would do now for your character is you would say, I want to be stronger than normal. So I may say, okay, well, anything that you do that is flat lifting, you don't have a strength attribute, okay, let me stress that. But anything you do that involves just like deadlifting, we will give you a +2/+2. And we'll value that somehow, that this is worth, let's just say, 20 points.
Okay, so this is more of a relational model.
Right, but now you are a positive 20-point character. So if we are playing a 0-point campaign, you would now have to say, okay, well, as a -10 points, I have a mild fear of heights. And as another minus 10 points, I have a minus 1 to my intellect because I'm a little bit slow in the head. And so your character is just all these deviations from a mathematical norm.
I take 100 points in shooting guns, and I'm terribly afraid of purple bunnies.
But,
see, it's only worth minus 2.
Yeah, exactly. Point-wise, that'd be worth nothing. But the great thing about this game, and what we were actually developing this for, was a superhero game, because it allows you to try and balance all these really weird things.
Superheroes have super weaknesses.
Exactly.
So there you go.
So you have Superman's strength, but there's a rock that's apparently not too hard for bald people to get a hold of that will kill you.
Speaking of, I started watching Smallville this week. Kryptonite is everywhere. It's like they made the town out of kryptonite.
Well, the meteor fell on Smallville. I mean,
didn't have a nuclear explosion, though.
When you make an invincible cardboard character who has only one weakness, you have no choice but to have that just popping out of every plot hole along the way. You know, that system we came up with, the deviation from the norm, worked great for a superhero game because it allowed you to try and quantify these really divergent ideas without being bound simply to these attributes. But once again, I just don't really see that as being necessary for most games. I'd be curious if anyone out there is familiar with the game and that can actually send us some kind of information on someone else's complete remodeling.
We will rip them off with no shame.
We promised to say we looked at it.
Yeah. I like the system we have.
I do too. I think the system that got put together today is very tight.
Let's talk about attributes. With the attributes on a character sheet, you're talking about just the base capabilities of someone outside of any training. This is how strong they are, how smart they are, how fast they are, how charismatic they are.
Or how not fast or charismatic.
Right. The concept's fairly easy, but what I want to talk about here for a moment is picking the attributes that are right for your game.
More is more?
That's a brilliant tautology. Anyone else?
I think
one equals one.
I think
my question is more geared toward more attributes. Do you want to define more on the sheet? Is that better?
Yeah,
I think it depends on your game.
It depends on the game, because obviously if you're looking...
Oh, it depends on the feel!
Well, the feel of the game. I really think so.
If you're looking for a quick play game that's really just more about the story, you don't need that many attributes. I mean, you need a couple, but you don't need that many. Whereas if you've got a game where you're trying to drill down really to the super nitty-gritty of what a person's capable of, maybe you need tons of them. I'd also look at what's significant, because you have to remember that what these attributes quantify is not just how good or bad you are in area X of your life, but it's also used to compare how much better or worse you are than the other things in your world. For example, when we started the Skies of Glass one, we had actually broken out someone's physical accuracy into agility and dexterity. Agility for their gross motor accuracy, like walking a tightrope or doing handstands, versus dexterity, which was their fine motor skills, like using a sewing needle or typing on a keyboard. And what we found is that in Skies of Glass, really the distinction was not that important to us. That the way these attributes would be used, which is probably in most cases going to be in combat, the difference really didn't matter. Whereas I had messed around with a science fiction game where this did matter because you had alien races that were these big, slow, immovable heaps that should not have any kind of agility, but they might have small appendages or whatever that have an enormous accuracy, which I have to represent in terms of their ability to fashion tools or electronics or whatever the case
may be. And if you had just the one attribute, you'd have these giant, huge, hulking things doing ballet dances.
Right, or
agility bonus to their armor class.
Or on the flip side, because they're movable heaps, I'd have to knock their single skill or attribute way down, in which case they could no longer perform the feats that racially
they are now gelatinous cubes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But within Skies of Glass, we found that distinction really wasn't all that important.
People are people, and people know generally what people are capable of.
Right.
People.
There's just one kind of folks, Jim. Perhaps. Just folks.
Based off of attributes, a lot of times you get derived stats. We should probably take a second to talk about those, because we chose to go a little bit of a different direction with these in Skies of Glass. Let's take a game, for example, Dungeons & Dragons is an example. Your hit points are based strongly on your constitution. Now, there are games out there where actually your hit points are based directly upon your constitution. Like in Battletech, your hit points are directly derived, at least in MechWarrior 2nd Edition, your hit points were derived directly from your build attribute.
Star Wars D20, I believe, is like that. You have your...
That is true.
Your wound threshold is equal to your constitution score or something like that.
Yeah, and then half of that is what you can take once you've blown through that.
I don't know there's really a whole lot to say about the derived attribute specifically that you can't say really without talking about the main attributes because they're derived from the main attributes. Just, I figure it's worth throwing out there just because they are in a lot of games. Now, Thin Sky is a class. We are also having a few, I don't know, meta attributes, if you will, which are attributes that are treated in a radically different way. Because, like, within Dungeons & Dragons, you make a save against your strength. Well, you've got a number you make a save against that or use some modifier from
it. In Skies of Glass, we have a save versus Turnip, a save versus Bullweevil,
right?
A save versus
Prairie Dog,
a save versus
Vicious, Carnivorous Prairie Dog.
And then when you roll bad, everyone at the table says, you're prairie dogging.
Like, for example, we haven't walked this one through specifically, so we may change this, but in our current sketch of the way that wounds will be done, we have an attribute for toughness that actually represents not how much damage you can take. So you're never directly rolling against or modifying this attribute, but it's almost used kind of like a general
hardiness.
Yeah, like almost as if it was an armor number. Like this is going to reduce the incoming damage by some amount just because of how resistant.
Have you ever seen the guy who can't take a punch? He gets punched once, and it knocks him right on his butt. And then have you ever seen the guy who gets hit in the back of the head with a 2x4, and it only makes him mad?
That'd be Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I am that guy.
There's actually
the first guy?
No, there's actually a fairly famous guy in history. That was his shtick. If you look up a guy by the name of Oofty Goofty, I think it's OOFTYGOOFTY.
My life has gotten worse.
Is that the guy who got shot in the belly with the cannon that we always see?
No, this was a guy who's actually...
Homer Simpson.
No, he was... This guy was actually around back during like the 1800s, Wild West sort of thing. And
I think we were the Wild East. Oh, wait, no, 1800s, not 18th century. Go.
He had some kind of shtick where he just was circus freak sort of thing and ended up losing that act because he had invented some kind of persona. But what he found was he got kicked out of a bar one day and realized that it didn't hurt. And so he would walk around charging people money to hit him. Like, you could hit him, but like punching him with so much money, kicking him with so much money, hitting him with a club with so much money.
I think with a name like that, you wouldn't have to pay me much. No.
And for a long time, nobody heard him until one day it hurt him and then he had to stop. But so, I mean, yeah.
What a touching, heartwarming, family-filled story.
I love that, though.
I was outrageous.
Oofty goofty.
It's brilliant.
You completely made that up, didn't you?
No, I didn't. You can actually look this up online. Look
on Google? Or on Wikipedia?
You can look it up anywhere.
Oh, that makes it real.
This is what comes from
Wikipedia. Is a credible source, John.
Absolutely. I cited in all my academic papers. No, I never do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about skills.
Let's. Right. I don't want to talk about Wikipedia. People.
Skills strike me as a really tough thing to do. Because you have to strike an immediate balance. You've got this continuum you're on. You have to pick where you want to fall. On one side is accuracy. On the other side is reasonable writing.
Yeah. Are you talking about like the Star Trek D&D thing where you have the character sheet and every single skill that you could ever have is already printed on the paper, or where another game where there's skills and it's just blank lines going down?
I don't mean that. What I mean is if you think about everything that you know in a way that you could at least quantify as a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10. You probably know information in thousands of subject areas. For example, when's the last time you played a role-playing game? And I'm sure there are some out there, but the vast majority of them don't. Where you had a basic skill in simple mathematics. You knew how to add and subtract, and that was represented on your character sheet.
And you can't recall. I guess you're saying it's like, how far do you want to drill down?
Yeah, exactly.
Tying my shoes, should that be a skill?
Monotonous, the role-playing game.
Yeah.
Getting dressed.
And it seems like the solution to this in most role-playing games is you immediately run to, all we're going to track is combat skills and combat support skills.
Yeah.
Well, what other skills are there?
Because it's like, we don't need a math skill on there because we just assume that everyone can do basic math.
Well, but I count the enemies.
But you don't assume that everyone in an army can shoot a gun. So it's like, why does one, if you think about it, put them on that kind of level, why is one skill necessary and the other isn't? Well, because
one kills.
Yeah, one
kills. In a role-playing game, accuracy and mathematics, nobody deals with. But when you murder somebody, that's when you have to drill down to specifics.
Well, and you don't get nearly the satisfaction out of blowing somebody away as you do when you do A squared plus B squared equals C squared.
That's true.
It just does not.
You do if you're Edward James Olmos. He does both frequently.
Are you a finger man?
No, am I?
Actually, we're not going to do it in this iteration, but in the original iteration of Skies of Glass years and years and years ago, we actually went to the far extreme and said, you know what? We can't possibly document everything a person knows. So what we're going to do instead is you take basic skill packages, real simple skill packages. Like you may say that I am a hunter. And you kind of describe...
I am a poop smith.
You describe what you did in your background, and then based on that, it's just assumed, okay, these are the tasks you're good at, these are the tasks you're not good at. So you would use that hunter package to kind of get some sense, looking at your background, hey, I grew up in the woods, I did this, I did that, to see what you knew. And I don't think... We're definitely not going to do that in this iteration of Skies of Glass. I think we're actually going to go a little bit to the other end, and... we don't want this to be
a game balance end.
Well, we don't want this to be like a phone book, but we don't want something that's quite so open to interpretation as a skill package. So we are going to have skills you actually write out. We're trying to get fairly specific, but once again, without being too wild on this, because I don't want people to have 6 pages of skills written out.
My breathing skill.
But you don't want them to suddenly have wilderness lore and survival and then only have survival?
I don't follow.
In 3.0, they had wilderness lore as a skill. And that was actually tied to a couple of specific things that classes could do. But then in 3.5 came out, they got rid of that skill. Everything into survival.
I wasn't a big fan of 3.5, so I was not aware of that.
All right. Made a bunch of barbarian players and rangers very mad.
Well, that's because they're rangers.
They started raging everywhere. So.
Ah. And ranging.
And ranging. Ranging and raging.
Something else that I like in a lot of role-playing, actually, something else I like in very few role-playing games, because it's in very few role-playing games, is when they try and give a sense of, I don't know, sort of organic context to the skills. That, for example, if you take someone who's not all that smart, it's going to take a whole lot more work for them to become good at some mental task than someone who is intelligent. And I like how certain games, Battletech's an example, and in fact, actually it's the only example I'm having come to mind right now, where the attribute modifies the skill roll. And that's definitely something I want to do in our game is when you shoot skills, that attribute ties directly into it. So if you're a beginner, but you have a ton of just raw aptitude in this area, you still have a chance of doing at least fairly well. I mean, you're not going to do as well as an expert, but you have a chance of succeeding. Whereas someone with a mid-level skill, but who just has absolutely no aptitude, is clumsy, they're all thumbs, they're still probably not going to do real well at this.
I agree.
Huh.
That's a good idea.
Now, Chris, one of the things that you wanted to add to this game was a luck attribute. So go ahead and talk about that a little bit, what that is and kind of the role you feel it plays in the game.
Well, I think that I've always been fond of that type of attribute only because the reason you play any character in any role-playing game is because that particular character is unique. Otherwise, why would you even bother playing? It doesn't matter if you're a farmer in Skies of Glass, if you're a fisher person, or an angler.
Fisher person.
When you go
this
to
is your man.
This is not the PC podcast.
Hey, let me tell you something. When you go, when you work in a TV newsroom, you get that stuff shoved down your throat all the time. But anyway, tangent aside, there needs to be something that helps to really set that character apart. And MechWarrior, I think, did a good job of that with the Edge attribute. I've seen it done in other games as well, where you have that, quote unquote X factor ability, and I think that would be very much true in Skies of Glass. I mean, the reason your character is alive in the first place is somehow he's inherently lucky.
All right, so let's stop for a second here and define exactly what you mean by this X factor attribute and why you think it sets the character apart. Is what fundamentally we're getting at here is some kind of an attribute that really, in its simplest description, allows you to affect the random aspects of the game. You can either re-roll the dice or modify the dice rolls or...
Exactly. As opposed to life always sticking it to you, even though that's still going to happen, you have some ability or way to really kind of, either...
Stick it back.
Either stick it back or at least soften the blow, so to speak.
Why do you think that's important for a character in a role-playing game to have?
It kind of goes back to what I said before about, this character... If in one way or another is unique and has had that ability to stand out amongst the crowd, you're not Joe Commoner, you're not Ensign Redshirt, you are more than what really is around you, even if it's only subtly so.
And I don't know about this.
We actually had a kind of a pseudo debate about this with a friend of mine a while back, and this was mostly about D&D. Where I was talking, they were complaining about their attributes because they'd rolled and they weren't pleased with the rolls. And I noted to them, I said, look, the average attribute in D&D, depending on which edition you look at, is either 9 or 10. And if I average out your attributes, it's over that. I mean, you guys are certainly above average. I said, even if you're at average.
Oh, I only got a 16. You know,
well, and also,
let's
too.
Let's say your character had had two 12s, two 10s, two 8s. You're still perfectly average. And the retort was, well, wait a minute. As a character, I don't want to be average. I want to be something.
And that's what the WotC eventually agreed with when they did this 46 minus 1 thing.
Yeah, but that's also why you have level advancement. I mean, your third level fighter definitely is far more unique than your average Joe laborer. You know, and so that is just how it's translated in that game. Well, it's just with level advancement.
Especially within D&D, and this once again changed from second to third edition. But in third edition, if you were a first level character, you were already above average because mm-hmm. the average person on the street was a level 0 character who had like half a hit die and penalties and just about everything.
They introduced the commoner class that was basically the worst of every PC class added together.
But that's true. And so really in this game, I mean, even though there's still going to be skill and character advancement, there still needs to be that ability because, you know, there's a lot of brutality in this game. There's a lot of difficultness in this game. And since life is sticking it to you, you need to have your character needs to stand out in his ability to either A, you know, deaden that hit that's coming towards you or in a certain way be able to stick it back.
I don't know if this number is going to endear this character to me any more or less or even make me feel like this guy is any more special than anybody else on the planet.
But why wouldn't you?
I think it's a cool mechanic.
You know,
don't
I think
get me wrong,
really but. The importance that I agree with what Chris is saying, but the importance that I would put on it, it's a frustration averter because I feel almost helpless in games where you throw that one die down and if it sticks it to you, it sticks it to you and there's nothing you can do about it. And I know some people say, oh, wait, that's part of the attraction, that just like in real life, you can't control the result. Bad things happen. And I don't have a problem with that per se.
But,
you know, within real life, there are things you can do to kind of hedge your bets and such, or you can be careful. And you just don't have that option. So I like the fact that you have some kind of escape hatch where if you're just having that where just everything is failing and failing and failing, you have a way of stepping in there and at least hedging that a little bit. You can re-roll a couple dice or something.
Yeah, this is not to say that you're going to get off scot-free, not in the least, but...
And it's not even really an issue of realism so much as it is keeping an element of fun in the game, because just failing all the time for reasons you have zero control over eventually becomes frustrating.
And you do see aspects of this in real life, particularly with professional athletes. When you look at, you know, oh my gosh, how did he make that shot? How did he catch that pass? And you could attribute it to the guy's athleticism, but you know, odds are that person has that something special that makes that person unique. Somebody is, you know, role playing Jerry Rice.
Jerry Rice is the man. He almost won Dancing with the Stars. That's right. I went there. Moving on.
For the Skies of Glass Q&A today, we're going to field a question that has been asked in various forums by a couple people.
Plaguing the forums.
The person that has asked it most recently and who I'm going to credit the question to is Zanian Zero from our forums. Actually, I guess I'd be crediting the question to whom.
Zab Zubity Zanian.
Excuse my grammar there. But the question that he brought this up kind of more being facetious. He didn't phrase it as a question. But he came up with a joke about where the name Skies of Glass came from. And he actually pinned it back to the, I guess, series finale of Saint Elsewhere, which I've actually never seen an episode of.
It is my mother's favorite TV show, and I've never seen a single episode.
I've seen almost every single episode and the season finale he's talking about.
I remember the show.
How was it?
Howie Mandel was in there.
The show was great. The season finale was a little weird. And I can't tell you. It's
like, yeah, I mean, without ruining
it. Well, it's not even ruined. It's like this whole context thing.
Huh. Okay. The question that the joke he was making is about where the name Skies of Glass came from. So I'd like to go ahead and answer that. And I cannot answer this question completely because this name sort of has a growth cycle it's gone through. It's come from a few places. One of the places that it came from was when we were messing around the history of this game before, we had written some of it from the perspective of sort of a historian philosopher who was observing the phases that mankind had gone through, and he talked about the different skies that he had seen over the world. And one of the skies that he talked about was what he called the Skies of Glass, which was the moment after the atomic bombs dropped. So you had what he was calling the Skies of Fire. But then there was these several hours of just complete peace where everything was just dead silent and really nothing of interest at all was going on outside of what had happened hours ago. And he referred to this as the skies of glass because this great still fell over the world. That was one of the places it came from. One of the other places we took it from was we had written a poem a while back because we want to tell the story in some ways through kind of a collection of items from around the world, which you guys will see more of the deeper we get into this. But one of the things that we had used to tell us before was there was a poem.
Was it a limerick?
No, it's not a limerick, and nor did it start off with...
There once was a game from Nantucket?
Nor was there once a woman from Venus.
Nice.
But the poem talked about how he felt as if he was beneath skies of glass, as if the world was almost like an aquarium or a prison that had trapped mankind to it. And I have to admit that while, like most angsty gamer kids, I wrote tons of depressive poetry that I thought was great, the truth is I can't write poetry. And most of you can't either. But we would like to find a really good poet who can try and do something with that, clean up that idea at some point. And actually, I have someone in mind, the brother of my brother-in-law, who actually has some kind of like college degree in English with an emphasis in poetry. So I may get him.
Does he actually produce?
Yeah, actually, he has. He's written some pretty good stuff,
Lies,
too.
I don't know a single writer that produces.
Then you're not checking our resources section, because there's nothing but produced writing there, jerky boy.
I know.
So anyways, we may try and get something done with that, but that is the answer to the question of where the name Skies of Glass came from. So hopefully we can give you a poem to actually context that properly.
So it's not Dome Cities?
No.
Damn.
And that was not, my guess.
It's not Logan's Run? Damn.
And it's not, like, nuked sky, you know, that turned the sky, the very clouds into glass for no apparent scientific reason. And
there was sand in the atmosphere from global warming. The water vapor introduced sand, so when the A-bombs went off, it superheated it, and glass shards rained down from the sky.
It was pretty a bad cool. Night.
I thought you were inspired by that scene from Dark Knight Returns when the nuke goes off and Superman's right there in the desert when it happens.
No, actually, if I was to cite one thing as probably being the single greatest outside inspiration for the name, it would actually be, there's an old classic Star Trek episode called For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky.
Nice.
Or The World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, or something to that effect. You work those words around somehow. We don't have an anus joke to end this one, but Chad.
It's a damn shame.
Well, we do, because you just talked about Klingons, and of course, we all know where Klingons are.
Oh, yeah, that kind of Klingon.
No, we'll have to end with the only anus on the podcast, Chad.
Chad, take it on home.
You.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.